Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Department of Dance students in imaginative concerts of their choreography. The March and April studio dance events, welcoming the Mark Morris Dance Group for its fifth season of performances and community engagement, and discovering the hip-hop artistry of Rennie Harris Pure Movement. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain at the controls. I'm sorry to say that we have not managed to hook up with our scheduled guest for this hour of Focus, Michael Shermer from Skeptic Magazine. We were going to be talking about his book, Science Friction. It's a recent collection of essays, and we'll see if we can get him scheduled for another day. Instead, we're going to the Focus 580 archives for a conversation from January. The guest on this program, Jeff Hawkins, he's a computer architect, the founder of Palm Computing, and we talked with him on January 10th about his book on intelligence. So do keep in mind as you listen that in this hour of the show, we will not take phone calls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with a man who has been called the father of handheld computing. His name is Jeff Hawkins, and he is the inventor of the Palm Pilot. He founded both Palm Computing and Handspring, also created the Redwood Neuroscience Institute to promote research on memory and cognition, which is something that he has been interested in for quite a long time. And we'll be talking this morning about his recent book, came out back in the fall, which is entitled On Intelligence. The subtitle, How a New Understanding of the Brain Will Lead to the Creation of Truly Intelligent Machines, and it is published by Times Books. And in the book, he makes the argument that a lot of the people working in the field of artificial intelligence have tended to look at the human brain as simply another kind of computer. They believed that getting a computer to think like a human is basically just a programming problem. All you have to do is develop the right program, and the computer will be able to match, perhaps even exceed, the abilities of humans. Our guest, however, says that this is the wrong way of thinking about the brain. He says the brain is not a computer, and this misunderstanding, he says, has held back the development of intelligent machines. He argues that the brain is a memory system, and what it does is it forms a model of the world and then uses that model to predict future events. Mr. Hawkins, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
And we certainly appreciate it. Well, just to begin, you would certainly say that the kinds of questions that you are interested in, think about, have written about, questions like what is intelligence, how does the brain work, you would say, above all, that these are questions that can be answered. We may not have an answer for them today, but they are questions that can be answered.
Absolutely. You know, there's very few things in the world which we ultimately can't get answers to. There are perhaps a few, but history has shown that things that seem completely mysterious for many, many years or decades or centuries actually can often have very simple explanations. And there's lots of examples of this going back over the history of science and technology, for example. So there's no question in my mind when I started getting interested in this field that, hey, you know, just because we didn't understand how the brain worked and it looked very confusing doesn't mean that we can't understand it.
This is something that is this area of brain function that has interested you, it sounds like, for quite a long time.
Yeah, 25 years ago, I'm a computer scientist, basically, and 25 years ago, I was looking at the field of AI, artificial intelligence, and people wanted to build machines that were intelligent. And I said, that's a good thing to do. I mean, maybe we can make machines that help humans quite a bit, and we can make smart machines. But the approach they were taking just seemed flawed to me. It was, programming a computer without really understanding what intelligence is or how brains work seemed like it wasn't going to be successful. And so I got interested in saying, look, before we can build intelligent machines or before we can try to replicate that, let's figure out how brains work, what they do actually first, and then how do they do it. And it seemed to me one of the great scientific questions of all time, actually, figuring how we think.
Yeah. Well, before we go into that in some detail, and I demonstrate my incomplete understanding of the ideas here in the book, let me ask you, and this is something, again, I'm sure that we'll talk about as we go along, but up front, perhaps I should ask the so what question. That is, if we do indeed come to the kind of understanding that you're talking about, if we really get a good understanding of what intelligence is, how the brain works, then then what do we do with that? And what will that mean for the design of computers and other sorts of machines?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, if it's one of these, I've said already, it's one of these problems that, one of these questions about, you know, how does the brain work or how do we think, that has many ramifications. For starters, it's just a great philosophical question. You know, what does it mean to be human? If we can understand how we produce the behavior we do and how we think, it's just an interesting philosophical question. It's sort of like studying evolution or something like that. You'd say, well, where do we come from? How do we get here? It's interesting. Of course, there's some very practical benefits of this as well. When you understand how it is we think and how we learn and really the mechanisms of the brain, then you can learn a lot about how we should train our kids or what can go wrong during the education process. How do we make ourselves better, and how do we make our children better? And then finally, the thing which really motivates me to a large extent is if with this understanding, you can build machines that aren't human-like but work on the same principles. It's not a matter about building sort of robots or something like that. It's a matter of building machines that can perceive the world the way you and I do and can be really smart. And this is going to be a huge and beneficial industry. It's somewhat like the computer industry was a very huge and arguably mostly beneficial industry. A technology that built on brain science has had tremendous ramifications for making technology that makes our lives better and helps us figure out the way the world works. And you know, you can come up with a lot of idealistic end goals, and I don't want to get too glassy-eyed here, but I think it's quite a big thing, and it's quite important to do, actually.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what other people have, the other kinds of ways of thinking about this that have been followed, and starting with your kind of characterization of the problems with some of the people, at least, doing work in the area of artificial intelligence, proceeding from this idea that the brain essentially is like a computer, and if all we have to do is build a big enough computer, given enough memory, given enough processing power, and pretty soon, it's just a matter of scale and maybe also programming. Pretty soon, we'll have intelligent machines.
Yeah, well, it was a logical thing to think. You know, when digital computers were invented, really about 50 years ago, when they started coming into common usage in some place, in academia at least, it was logical to think, look, we have this powerful machine. It can do symbolic logic. It seems like humans must be doing symbolic logic. We can program it. We can make machines that do what humans do. It turned out to be really, really hard. In fact, almost impossible. In fact, the easiest things that humans do, like looking at something and saying what it is, or understanding language, or walking around the room, we've never even begun to approach any kind of capability, even of a fly. We're so far away from what nature has done in biology with our computers. So I don't want to blame people for thinking that was what they could do because it seems sort of logical. But it turned out to be wrong, that the brain is not at all like a computer. It's not like a digital computer. And until you really understand what the brain does and how it does it, you're not going to be able to program a computer to do something similar. And people in the field of AI generally will not disagree with this assessment. They will basically say, yeah, you're right. We really haven't succeeded here. Although there are still some people who believe that, well, we're making great progress in AI and all we need is bigger computers. Most AI researchers have gone off of that. And they said, well, we're kind of stuck. We need a new way of thinking about this, a new way of approaching the problem.
Well, also, Lynn, let me have you talk a little bit about another approach, something that you said is a little bit better because it comes closer to the way the human nervous system is structured. That is the idea of the neural network. But it still apparently is a far cry from the way the brain really works, but is at least a little bit, as I said, it makes more sense because it's a better imitation of what it is we can see the nervous system does.
Yeah, well, in fact, the neural network world came out partly because of the failures in AI. Some people said, well, you know, programming computers doesn't seem to be working too well. Maybe, you know, if brains are made of a bunch of cells called neurons, maybe if we start, emulating or simulating a bunch of neurons and hook them together, we might be able to figure out, how brains work and how to build intelligent machines. And in the mid-80s, this field really blossomed, the neural network field. And a lot of interest in it. One of the problems, of course, it's correct. The brain is a neural network in some sense, and therefore, if you, it's a good way of approaching the problem. the problem that they ran into is that the neural networks that people built or studied were extremely simple. I mean, trivially simple compared to a real brain. And not just in the number of cells, because a human brain has many billions of cells, but it's kind of ignored the large-scale architecture. They ignored, you know, what we know about the anatomy of the brain and its structure, and there's a lot of structure, and they just kind of ignored it completely. And they said, well, what happens if we put, you know, a bunch of neurons together, you know, 100 neurons, and see how they interact? It's not wrong. It's just not going to get you to the answer to the problem, because they were kind of ignoring almost all of what we know about biology.
Mm-hmm. So, but overall, it seems that one of your main criticisms of both these approaches is that it focused too much on in a sense, on output, on what was coming out of the box, so to speak, rather than what was happening inside the box. It was focused on result and not on process. And that what you really need to do, if you're going to try to understand what intelligence is, you have to look at the process, not simply the result.
Yes. In fact, well, I'll try to be a little bit more, I'll try to be succinct about this. It's natural to think, okay, well, if I were to build a machine that was intelligent, how would I know? And you might say, well, I would know if it has the right behavior, right? So this is there's a famous thing called the Turing test, which is essentially, can you get a computer to emulate a human such that another human couldn't tell the computer from a person? And, you know, it seems natural. Well, okay, the ultimate measure of intelligence is how you behave and what you do, so a machine that behaves the same way would be intelligent. That's actually very misleading, and what you really need to understand is what is a brain doing before you actually try to create one. And both neural networks and AI were focused on, like, getting the right result. You know, I put some input into the system, and does it produce the right output? I put in a picture, does it tell me what it is? I put in a question written in English, and does it give me the correct answer, type of thing? But human intelligence is much more complex than that. It's more subtle. The listeners of this radio show right now can be very intelligent, and they don't have to do much at all. They're listening to us speak. They're understanding it. They're forming various sorts of memories and impressions about it. It may influence their future behavior, but right at the moment, they're not doing anything outwardly behaviorally intelligent, perhaps. And so we had to get to the bottom of what really is an intelligent system. And I had this. I came across the sort of the answer to this in the mid '80s. It's a number of other people did as well, and it's now a fairly common held belief. But although in neuroscience, although not everyone adheres to it, but basically what the brain does to make us intelligent is it builds a model of the world, a memory of the world, and it uses this memory to predict the future, in essence, to know what's going to happen next. So as you walk around, you experience the world, and you see things, and you feel things, and you hear things, and your brain is continually having expectations. So you have expectations about what something's going to feel when you pick it up. So if I pick up a pen right now, I have expectations what it's going to feel like and how it's going to behave. Listeners will have expectations of what I'm going to say or what word is at the end of this sentence, because your brain has built a model of the world, and it's all about prediction of the future, which is the essence of intelligence. Its behavior is a sort of a secondary attribute, but really predicting the future and knowing what's going to happen is the key to understanding how the brain works.
Hmm. So why didn't I guess, as sort of I understand the idea of the neural network, one of the selling points of that was the idea that it actually could learn. Why is that somehow the neural network or that kind of approach didn't yield the kind of result that you're looking for?
Well, they do. First of all, an intelligent system has to learn, which is one of the problems a lot of the AI systems had trouble learning. And their neural networks do learn. But a typical neural network, it's a very simple system. I won't describe it unless you want me to. But you provide it with a pattern, an input. And you say, here's the input. And you say, here's what the output should be for this input. And you say, you train, you say, okay, when I show you this input, give me this output. And then you give it another input, and you say, when I show you this input, this is what the output should be. And essentially what you're trying to do is get this neural network that when you give it some new input, a novel one, one it hasn't seen before, it will give you, quote, what the expected output is. Very much focused on input-output. There's no concept of the neural network knowing what it's doing or being able to predict the future or being able to have expectations. It's just a matter of, you know, input, output, you know, immediately, you know, put it in and get it out. In fact, another thing, humans, as you and I and all humans, the inputs coming into our brains are continually changing over time. And the outputs are continually changing over time. And neural networks don't capture that either. They're basically pretty much static. You give it a pattern, you get an output, and then that's it. And then you give it another pattern, you get an output, and that's it. So it's very, very far from what brains do, and it was focused on this input-output paradigm. And they were useful for certain things, neural networks were, but they didn't come close to capturing what brains are doing or how they do it.
Mm. So the bottom line here is it sounds like it's at least in large part, it is a memory issue, but it's not so much volume as it is ways in which memory is stored and ways in which memory is connected.
That's correct, David. We can think of those who are familiar with computers, like your desktop computer, you can say, well, that has memory too. And that's one type of memory. You know, and in that kind of in computer memory, you when you put something into it, you expect to be able to get the exact same thing out again. The memory in your brain actually works differently. It's just a different type of memory system. It's still memory, and that is, it's storing things all the time, but it does it in a very different way. And there's a few major attributes how it's different than, let's say, a computer memory, and those attributes are very, very important to understanding how the whole system works. They're not terribly difficult to understand, and I describe them in the book, but they are something that is unexpected. So, for example, the memory in your brain is one that focuses on sequences of patterns, time-based patterns like songs or what happens after what. The memory in a computer doesn't inherently do that. We can make it do that, but it doesn't naturally do that. The memory in your brain does do it naturally. It's also, the memory in your brain is organized in a hierarchy, which I describe at length in the book. It's not a hard concept, but it's a hierarchical structure, and therefore the memories are stored in a hierarchical structure. And that's different than any kind of computer. So there's a number of these differences, and you're right, it's not the actual quantity of memory that matters. It's modeling the system and say, how does the brain actually form memories of the world, and how does it use them? And once you understand that, you can build machines that are more memory than a human or less memory than a human. It's the method or the process, as you say.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Jeff Hawkins, a man who has been very successful in the business of designing computers. He founded both Palm Computing and Handspring. He also created the Redwood Neuroscience Institute to promote research on memory and cognition. He is the author of a book that lays out the ideas here we're discussing, if you would like to read about them in greater depth. It's titled On Intelligence, How a New Understanding of the Brain Will Lead to the Creation of Truly Intelligent Machines, and it is published by Times Books. His co-author, by the way, on the book is Sandra Blakesley, who is a science writer and has been writing about science and medicine for the New York Times for more than 30 years. The book came out last fall. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. And questions are welcome. If you'd like to talk with our guest, you can do that too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I hope you'll bear with me as I try to lay these ideas out, because they're not that simple, and not at least, you know, it's what I'm trying to do is maybe change your frames of reference a little bit and suggest that maybe part of the problem in understanding intelligence is that the brain is too limiting of a model to use. And I think that perhaps what might be more beneficial in trying to move forward and understanding intelligence is to look, rather than thinking just in terms of the brain, look and think in terms of the mind, which is a larger concept than just the brain. And that certainly other parts of the body as a whole, there's a lot of evidence that intelligent activity is taking place even down at the cellular level. And beyond that, maybe a thing that would help to give insight is if we could really understand what intuition is. And certainly people who use intuition, such as medical intuitives like Carol Mace and certain high-level martial artists who are able to perceive and anticipate what their opponent's going to do before they even begin to do it, might see the mind, or the brain rather, to at least part of its function as a tuning device, just sort of like a radio tuner tunes into different stations that you can use your brain or perhaps your entire mind to tune in to different frequencies or, you know, information that's outside yourself, and use that as a way of making decisions or understanding what's going on. And I think that that's something that's more than just the central nervous system, and that if you limit yourself to the model of the central nervous system, you may not be able to get beyond some of those roadblocks of understanding of what intelligence is.
Can I go ahead. So you bring up a lot of points, so it'll be difficult to try to address them all. First of all, you could break the world into two camps. There are people who believe that that the mind is what the brain does, and there are people who believe that no, somehow the mind is something else, and that there's some sort of metaphysics going on. The caller didn't necessarily say that, but it's sort of implied. And I'm definitely in the former camp, and most people are, that basically there's no reason to believe that everything a human does can't be explained by the way the cells work in your brain. There's quite a few of them there, and they, and if it seems a bit mysterious, it's because we don't understand it. But the mind and the brain are not really sort of separate things. It's not like, oh, you just have this brain, which is sort of just a bunch of meat over here, and somehow there's an ethereal component that is outside of that. I don't believe that, and almost no neuroscientists or other scientists believe that either. And, in fact, in the book, I pretty much describe a lot of the stuff you're talking about. I'll get into, for example, intuition. You talked about intuition sort of being an ability to anticipate. Going back to what I said earlier, this is what the brain does. And I need to be a little bit careful here. When the book is mostly about a part of the brain called the neocortex. This is the part that is associated with intelligence. This is the part that it does speaks and is listening, and all of our high-level thoughts and planning and motor actions and so on, almost all high-level human sort of intelligent activities in the neocortex. So that's what I'm referring to as talk about the brain. But the neocortex, what it does is it makes predictions. And because you never experience the world the same way twice in your life, that is, the patterns coming into your body are never the same, that you're always doing this by analogy. You're always making predictions by analogy. So the brain uses its memory model of the world to say, hey, here's a pattern coming in. I think I've seen something like this before. Let me anticipate what it's going to do based on previous experience I've had. And I go through the mechanism of this in the book. And this is what intuition, or this is what creativity is. It really is basically saying, I'm going to make predictions about novel events based on analogy to past events. Sometimes those analogies are very direct. If I'm playing chess, it might remind me of a previous chess game I played. And I say, oh, this is similar to the such and such a game I played 4 years ago. But sometimes we make analogies across modalities. I may say, you know, designing a computer is like raising children, and therefore I'll have some ideas about how to design a computer based on previous experience raising children. But that is the essence of the brain's algorithm, is prediction by analogy, and that is intuition, that is creativity. It doesn't actually require anything, you know, special thing that, you know, mind sauce that once you understand how the neurons do this, it kind of comes out automatically. So I guess I would agree with the caller that that we do need to sort of think about these other issues such as intuition and so on, and we need to obviously understand how the brain relates to the body. But I do think you can, and the book actually does go pretty much explain almost all of this in the terms of the neurobiology of the brain.
Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Michael Gershon? And he's a gastrointestinologist and One of his books is called The Second Brain, referring to the digestive system as...
No, I'm not familiar with that. I'm sorry, it made me laugh, but to think about your...
Well, I mean, he's a serious, medical researcher. And in fact, when he first started presenting his work, he got the same kind of reaction from other scientists. But now his research has become, what is the standard in terms of understanding how the digestive system works. And I mean, after all, the more serotonin is produced and consumed within the digestive system as part of its function.
Yeah,
and in the central.
There's no doubt. So look, the human nervous system in its entirety, it's composed of many different components. There are in the actual skull itself. There are many subsections of the brain. There's the spinal cord. There's neurons distributed throughout the body, as you point out. Yet still, if you want to create a human, and I want to make a distinction between intelligence and building a human. If you want to base something that's like a human and that sees the world exactly like a human and feels like a human and is a human, then you'd have to, in some sense, recognize and understand and replicate all of that. But it turns out you can isolate a large part, the vast majority of what we consider intelligence, to a couple organs in the skull, the neocortex and the thalamus specifically, and another thing called the hippocampus. And those are the three objects I talk about most in the book. Mostly the neocortex, which is the big, big part of the human brain. This is the part that it's the big wrinkly thing on top, and it's well known that this is where almost all your conscious memories of the world are. If I were to ask you something and you can tell me about it, people you've met or things you've done and language you know and knowledge, anything you can tell me, that's all going to be in the neocortex. And almost all your perception occurs up there. Not all of it. Clearly, your body is out there too, and it's interacting with the world. But you can say, okay, what does the neocortex do on its own? And it interfaces with this other thing called the human body and all its stuff. And you can say, how does the neocortex understand that and interpret it? And it's not understanding everything it means to be a human, but it basically isolates out the part that says what is unique about human intelligence. A reptile has a body too, and it has, digestive systems. And it can do a lot of sophisticated behavior, but it doesn't have the neocortex. And the difference between you and I and a reptile is really much that wrinkly sheet of cells at the top, the neocortex. And that's the part that I'm focusing on. It's not a matter of, I'm not trying to build intelligent, human-like robots or anything like that. It's like, how do we build machines that perceive the world and understand it the way humans do, or can think about problems the way humans do, or can understand language and so on the way humans do? So I'm not dismissing the fact that there's other parts of the body and they're pretty important, but you can really kind of dismiss them when it comes to sort of understanding what the essence of intelligence is.
We are just a bit past our midpoint already. I appreciate the questions, comments of the last caller, and I have a couple of other people I want to get on to. And again, just to let me introduce our guest, Jeff Hawkins. He founded both Palm Computing and Handspring, has been for a long time very interested in the brain and how the brain functions. And in this book we've talked about On Intelligence, makes the argument that people who have been working in the field of artificial intelligence have not had as much success as they would like because of the way that they think about brain and its function. He says it's a mistake to think that the human brain is just another kind of computer. He makes the argument in the book that the brain is in fact a memory system, that what it does is it forms models of the world, looks for patterns, and then uses those to make predictions about what's going to happen next, and that a better understanding of the brain, its functioning, and intelligence will help us build smarter machines. And if you want to read about all of that, you could look for the book. It's titled On Intelligence, published by Times Books. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me just take another second and then we'll get on to some other callers. I hope I recapped well enough the basic idea is here.
You're doing great, David.
I guess, well, good. Some people might say, oh, well, okay, now we've got that down. Let's go out and build our computer. Where do we need to go from the kind of this sort of basic understanding of the brain to if that is correct, if that's really the way that it works, then how complicated a matter is it to design a machine that would model, that would take that as the model?
That's a great question. And, you know, since I've wrote the book, which was, you know, you finish a book, you know, I don't know if I get back in this late spring or early summer, we've been working on that problem. And the book describes the mechanisms of the neocortex and mechanisms of thinking in terms that most people can understand, not terribly technical terms. There's, and it shows the biology behind it. It shows how the architecture of the brain implements this, but it doesn't tell you how one might build this. But that's what we have been working on. And in fact, if you go to the book's website, which is onintelligence.org, there's some discussions of this, and there's also a link to another gentleman's name, Dilip George, who's working with me. And we've actually started modeling this stuff. What you can do is you can basically say, how do I encapsulate this mechanism in a mathematical formula? It's not that hard. It's essentially in the language of probability theory. And then you can actually program it. You can actually use a computer, as long as you're using the computer to model the memory system of the neocortex. And we're doing that, and it's actually working. We're actually getting some very very encouraging results. We've applied it first to solving some problems in vision. Today there is no machine that you can show it a picture of something and say, what is it? Humans can do this effortlessly. I can show you a picture of something and say, oh, that's a dog and a cat and a car and a phone and a person or whatever. There's no machine that can come close to that. And so we're applying this theory towards that problem. We're getting some very, very promising results. I don't think it's going to be that long before we actually start, you know, building these things of commercial value.
All right. Well, let's go to some other callers from folks we have listening here. The next is in Champaign and on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been listening over the years to these debates on computer intelligence, and I've sort of come to the conclusion that the one reason that the computer will never have human intelligence is that it doesn't have animal experience. What differs, the computer will always be a machine. The human is an animal. And if you can find for me a computer that has given birth and has teenage kids and has a mother-in-law and has a wife, then you tell me that I have these qualities, then I'll believe that the machine has intelligence.
You know, when you started your question, you said human intelligence, and I would agree with you 100%. If I wanted something that was a human equivalent, that had human, you know, that was the same as a human, it'd have to live the life of a human. I agree with 100%. The question is, can you understand what intelligence is, independent of whether it's a human or another animal, or independent of its manifestations? So what the book gets into is it describes how you separate what is the process by which we perceive the world, what is the process by which we make predictions about the world, and that component can be extracted from, you know, everything it means to be a human. To be a human, you have to have lust, you have to have, you know, fear, and you have to have all these human emotions, and you have to live this human life. But you know, a lot of what we do when you just perceive the world, or when you think about problems, or when you're playing chess and so on, or whatever it is you pick, a lot of it, you don't really require that. That's required to be a human, but it doesn't necessarily require to be intelligent. One way of looking at this is, if you look at the human brain, it's got sort of two major divisions. There's what we might call the old brain, which is what we share with a lot of other animals, like reptiles and so on. And then there's this part that's unique to mammals, and it's gotten really big in humans, and that's the neocortex. The old brain is what is required to be that animal, to eat, to be hungry, to have, you know, lust, to mate, whatever. And we have that. But we also have this new part that only mammals have, and then it's gotten very large in humans. And it's the new part which I'm interested in. It's the new part which says, okay, above and beyond what it means to be an animal and what it means to be, you know, a blood and guts living thing, What is it that we do that's unique? How do we perceive the world? How do we make predictions? How do we anticipate and have intuition? Those mechanisms can be extracted and understood separately from the other stuff. And that's the point I make in the book, and I show how that can be done, and I think we're doing it. It's not to produce a human again. It's not to produce something that you and I would say, like out of some science fiction story, like an R2-D2 or C-3PO or something, whatever. You pick your favorite science fiction story. It's not to do that. It's to create a machine that says, hey, but I can perceive my world, too. It's not this, you know, and I can make predictions about it, and I understand it, and I can solve problems that we've not been able to do using any other technique.
Well, why don't you just refer to it then as a superior problem-solving machine?
Because I do think it gets at the core of what intelligence is. Not necessarily to be what it's like to be human, but this is the core of intelligence. And to say it's just a problem-solving machine doesn't do it justice. This is the way you solve problems. This is the way your brain solves problems. This is the way your brain perceives the world. And, in fact, I think we can make machines that are more intelligent than humans in many endeavors that humans struggle with. Humans struggle with concepts in mathematics or concepts in physics. Or there's many things we're not very good at, and it takes a lot of training to get there. And yet some of those we consider as the the exemplary what intelligence is. We can make machines that are clearly intelligent in these other areas, and more so than humans, but are human-like and don't pretend to be human in any sense whatsoever. I think it would be just justice to not say what it is. I think it is intelligence.
All right.
Well, it might be intelligence, but somehow or other I can't help but think that there is such a thing as animal experience, which is at the root of certain kinds of intelligence that can't be duplicated outside of animal experience.
That's true. Look, if I want to have an intelligence of how to use my body to do physical things, I have to have a body and I have to live the life of a body. But there's no reason I couldn't make a car that had a set of sensors and a set of mechanisms,
sure.
And its body is different than yours and mine, and it experiences the world differently and experiences a different world, but it works on the same principles.
Okay.
The point of this is if you understand how the brain actually performs these things, if you understand the mechanisms underlying it, then you can take those mechanisms and say, what can I do with them? What's useful? And what does it tell me about humanity? What does it tell me about raising my kids? It tells you a lot about that stuff. And it tells you, why does it take 18 years to train a child? these kind of things, why is it hard to learn a language after you're older than when you're young? It explains a lot of these things. And so it's useful to understand how the brain does it.
Well, let's talk with someone else, and next we'll go to Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. The previous caller mentioned how, mothers-in-law and teenagers and emotions, kind of make people more intelligent than computers. You know, someone might suggest that they actually make people stupider. what I wanted to say was, the neural networks seem like they don't always do so well. But on the other hand, what a neural network is expected to do is basically learn all by itself, which is basically whereas human beings in modern society, we have education with this societal memory, which allows young people to leverage. All this information that's been stored, and so in an experimental laboratory, what a neural network is required to do is basically the equivalent of a feral baby growing up in the wild with absolutely no parents, no training, no education at all.
Well, some neural networks are like that. There's quite a few that require a trainer that where someone sits there and says, here's what you should learn. In fact, I would say most of them are like that. Some are self-training. Quite a few require a teacher. So I don't necessarily think that's the right distinction between them. But I do agree with you completely that one of the, and I wrote about this in the book, about the sort of societal memory. And language led to this, that why is our species so successful dominating this planet? And it very much has to do with the fact that we can pass on what we learn in a lifetime to our offspring. And most species don't have a very good way of doing that. In fact, I know so much about the world that I've never actually firsthand experienced. I know about different parts of the world, different cultures and so on, but I've never actually seen. And the only reason I know about this stuff, or the universe, I know about, galaxies and cosmology and so on. The only reason I knew about it is because I read about them. It's a cultural memory. And it's a unique thing that's pretty unique to humans because of our language, and has led to the spiraling success or at least our spiraling dominance of our species. And I would agree with you on that. I think going back, the earlier comment you made was funny about having the emotions in the kids and the mother-in-law might make you stupid. Sometimes when I grow up, I always felt like, you see those pictures of the little devil over one side of your head and an angel over the other side of your head. And I feel like that sometimes. It's like your neocortex is like saying, logically, you ought to be doing this, but then the old part of your brain is saying, well, logic be damned, I'm going to go eat that chocolate cake anyway, or chase after that girl or whatever it is you shouldn't be doing. So I do think we sort of live those sort of two lives in our head sometimes.
So if you'd like to explain, maybe give some idea of why you think that these computer networks don't always do as well. I could just hang up and listen.
I mentioned earlier. I'll just say it briefly again. You have to first understand what the brain is doing, and then you have to understand how it does it. Our intuitions about what the brain is doing are wrong. They're just wrong, and they're intuitively obviously, but wrong. And so almost all neural networks and almost all AI, and there's a few exceptions, but almost all those people who've studied in this field and worked in this field didn't actually understand what the brain is all about and what is it doing, and they've basically been following the wrong paradigm. So if you have the wrong assumption about what you're trying to accomplish, you're just not going to get the result you want. And this happened. The AI researchers, they thought certain things would be simple. They thought like computer language understanding or vision understanding would be simple. They really thought it was simple. It doesn't sound that hard. You have a picture, you just analyze it. Turned out that those are the most tremendously difficult problems and didn't make any progress at all, and they got stymied. And so you have to first understand how does the brain go about doing this, and then you can come back and say, oh, it's not intuitive, but not too hard to understand, and now we can start building that stuff.
Let's go to another caller. We have two people here who are on cell phones. We'll take first line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think what you're saying is very interesting. I'm going to make it kind of quick. Just a few random comments. I think drawing the line between mammals and other, or saying it's all in the neocortex is perhaps a bit strong. Birds, there's a number of birds, for instance, that are quite intelligent and are able to do a lot of the conceptual reasoning things that, not at the level that a human can, but obviously pretty sophisticated. So if you would comment on that. The other one, the random one, and then I'll hang up, is the issue of the emotions. There's some thought... From what I understand, and this is not my area, but I work in a tangential area, that the emotions are sort of a quick, it's like it's the knee-jerk reaction, as it were, although the knee-jerk reaction is happening in your knee, but it's that sort of higher-end version of that, and so you get angry and you get ready to do stuff very quickly, or you're elated or whatever. But it also forces you, in other things, it forces you to do things that maybe your reason wouldn't necessarily say that you should do, but
yeah,
which might seem unreasonable to you, but actually is perhaps in your better interest in some ways, like, for instance, pursuing that girl.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And so it's a mix. The emotions are very much a mixed bag. I mean, some they do wonderful things for you, but they also, lead you astray as well. Now I'm going to hang up and listen and let you make comments on the both unrelated questions. Thanks.
No, the question about birds and is a good one. I'm going to sort of give a very sort of rough sketch of how some of this evolved, but you could roughly say that a reptile has this old brain. and it has emotions, and it has behavior, and it has senses, and so on, and it has lust and fear and anger and fighting and all that kind of stuff. The mammals have evolved a structure on top of it, the neocortex. Birds evolved a separate structure, and or a separate set of structures. In some sense, the bird developed its own sort of higher intelligence. It's different. It wasn't. We weren't. You know, there's sort of two forks on the evolutionary tree there. And yes, the birds can be intelligent too, and they have structures that also do some similar things the way the neocortex does. Although, as you point out, very much more limited. You know, we can say a bird is intelligent; it can learn to do various things, but not close to what a human can do. But it's a separately evolved structure sitting on top of an old brain, and that's not unknown in nature. That similar things get evolved multiple times. Yes, you could say the bird is a little bit intelligent, and I wouldn't disagree with that. And it doesn't have a neocortex, but it's limited, very limited compared to human. The emotion side is really an interesting question, because most of the emotional centers of the brain are in the old brain. In a sense, they predate intelligence or predate the neocortex. As I said, you'd see in an alligator or another reptile, you see things like fear and hunger and lust and so on. In some sense, the neocortex is sitting on top of this old brain. It's like trying to ride a wild bronco. You know, the old brain is trying to do its thing, right? It's going to breathe when it needs to breathe, and it's going to fight when it needs to fight. And the new brain is sitting up there saying, "Well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this stuff, but I can't control it right now. We're going to go do it anyway." And you feel this tension. And the emotional centers of the brain are quite complex. There's a bunch of structures. It had been around for a long time, so a lot of evolutionary pressure on them. And you can sort of say, look, that stuff is going on. It's really important for a human or for an animal. And the neocortex deals with it in a sort of tangential way. Clearly, in the neocortex, your emotions have a big influence on what you learn, what you bother saving, what you bother storing for future use. And that's how the two sort of interact. The old part of the brain says, hey, this is emotionally very important, and you better remember it. And the neocortex will do it. And so there's these projections that go to the neocortex saying, basically, remember this. But the emotions themselves are not mediated or controlled in the neocortex. They are these subcortical structures. And I just like to think of it like the new brain is like this rational sort of person sitting on top of, you know, this bucking bronco of an old machine there, and you can't always control it. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can.
Let's talk with another caller again on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd just like to make a comment. I've worked with people in AI for a large number of years, and it seems to me that, first of all, their attitude is completely wrong-headed, and that what they're trying to do does, in fact, make no sense. Let me explain what I mean by that. We don't need, nor would I want, to create an artificial intelligence. We have real intelligence, if you call it that. It's what human beings do. I think what we really need is a different way of solving problems than people do. I mean, I don't need more computers any more than I need more people. And I think that when we try to create this so-called artificial intelligence by modeling it on what the human brain does, we're missing a very fundamental point. Flight, the way we accomplish it with airplanes, is not really based on the way birds fly. And so I don't really understand why we would want to basically imitate biology. And I think it's very off-putting to people when you talk about artificial intelligence, and also when you make analogies. There have been studies on Asperger's syndrome people, who are people who basically have a very, let's say, a high level of intelligence, but lack the ability to empathize with other people. In other words, they're very good problem solvers, but they lack what we call mindsight and don't understand what other people do. Now, we have computers that actually are very good Asperger's imitators. For example, mathematical software, we have Mathematica, and I've heard mathematicians say, well, that's an artificial intelligence, but it's a very specific type of intelligence. And I think when you focus on the neocortex, you're talking about just one of many, many different intelligences. And it would be much better to talk about problem-solving entities.
Yeah, so this is the argument that's been positive for many years for AI, why they've ignored brains. They say, look, just like you said, you know, planes don't flap their wings. Therefore, you know, we shouldn't be looking at brains because it's a limited purview of what the field of intelligence is. And it hasn't worked. You could argue that things like Mathematica are intelligent. Most people wouldn't. We're going to run out of time here shortly, I think, David, right? So
yes.
I could try to tell you a little bit of reaction I've got from this book, which
sure.
is interesting. The book was really written with two audiences, with multiple audiences. It's generally readable by anyone, but it's a biological theory and explains the mechanisms of the biology. But and so in the neuroscience world, it's been very well received. The surprising thing for me has been how well it's been received in the AI world. There's so many people in the AI world who basically say, you know what, we are looking for a new thing, and there's a ton of problems we don't know how to solve. From robotics to machine learning to vision to, you know, speech, there's a ton of things we just don't even begin to know how to approach. And they're actually quite excited about this because it sort of gets to the heart of all those problems. So you could say they're task-specific, but in some sense the brain solves all those problems in a common way. And once you understand that way, you don't have to emulate neurons. You don't have to emulate a brain. You can encapsulate this in some software or a piece of silicon. But you got to figure out first what the brain is doing. You know, what in analogy, what is flight? And then once you understand what it is, then you can say, how do I go build the thing? So the great thing is in the AI world, it's been terribly receptive to this. And I'm getting invitations to speak all over the place because there's quite a few people excited about it. And I do think it's going to actually result in a whole bunch of solutions to problems we don't know how to solve today.
Well, we're going to have to stop indeed because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are interested, you can read the book. It's titled On Intelligence by our guest, Jeff Hawkins. It's published by Times Books. Also, if you have internet access, there's a website for the book, which is onintelligence.org. You can go there. Our guest, Jeff Hawkins, many call the father of handheld computing. He founded both Palm Computing and Handspring. And Mr. Hawkins, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 program. We first broadcast on January 10th. We'll see if we can reschedule the show that we were expecting to do this morning, the conversation with Michael Shermer from Scientific American and Skeptic. Focus 580, our program made possible by grant from Bodywork Association.